You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
This is a podcast from comedianscomedian.com.
This is the Comedian's Comedian Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith, and in today's episode, I'm bringing you an absolute treat. This is Tommy Tiernan, long regarded as one of Ireland's finest comic exports. And at this year's Edinburgh Festival, Tommy, as you'll hear, was doing an extraordinary comic experiment. He was improvising an hour every night. I won't tell you any more about that because we're just about to talk about it. But it was one of the most enthralling hours of comedy question mark I think I've ever seen. It was a genuinely engaging and invigorating and completely absorbing hour with a good amount of laughs in it, but it was by no means a finished comedy show. Tommy will go on to explain exactly what he's after and why just now. Here he is. It's Tommy Tiernan.
I'll swap it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Tommy.
Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. So you are here at the Edinburgh. I'm going to crack straight into this. I've got loads I want to talk to you about. We have limited time. Great. So the first thing I want to just explain to people who might not be aware of what you're up to. Well, can you explain it in your own words? The show you're doing this year is sort of unlike anything you've done at the festival before.
It's okay. What is this now? It's very difficult to explain. It's entirely made up in the moment. So it's an improvised show, but with no games or audience suggestions. It's a kind of a showbiz version of a homeless man shouting at trucks. That's what it is. That's basically what it is. It's about... I'm very inspired by a piano player called Keith Jarrett, who would have started off in the 50s and 60s and played with Miles Davis and people like that. And then in the 1970s, when he got himself into some financial trouble, decided to start taking the biggest risks of his life, which were he would walk out in front of 2,000 or 3,000 people at a time and spontaneously compose full shows, piano shows in front of them. I started listening to him a few years ago, and I started to wonder, is that possible in stand-up? And so that's what I am. I don't think I'm very good at it. And I think that because it's so desperate, when there's, you know, 400 people looking at you and you're kind of, it's kind of like what I'm sounding like now.
Well, it is.
Except more people. But it's, what I was going to say was that I'm not entirely sure that the choices I make in the moment are the wisest, but they are the only ones available. So I think what I display when I'm doing the show is, first of all, my immaturity, the kind of the juvenile nature of my mind, and some funny stuff, and genuine despair as well. So they're all, it's a hard sell of a show. But that's basically what I
came to see it a couple of nights ago, and I think it's probably one of the most memorable and arresting things I've seen in comedy, because I was expecting to see someone improvising, as you say, not necessarily from audience suggestions, but I was expecting to see someone improvising almost like riffing. And yeah. You weren't riffing. It looked like someone trying to improvise a novel on stage. Does that resonate with you? That you would come out and...
No.
They come out and rather than kind of go, right, what have we got? What should we talk about? You yeah. sort of came out going, what is a yes. man? What is a man? What is humility? What is this thing I'm doing?
Yeah. Well, I think on the first night you were there, I think was, there's a lot of talking about the process when I start. So over the course of this run, I did the second one tonight. There is... I'm talking about what I'm doing as opposed to just doing it. So, but that hopefully will fade away after another show or so. But yeah, it's it's very hard to it's a hard thing to talk about, to be honest, because I don't know if you're probably better at explaining it than I am because you saw it. It seems that I end up in places that I wouldn't get to if I was putting an ordinary stand-up show together. So I find that some of the subjects I drift into, like I remember that night we were talking about Yeats and mm-hmm. James Joyce and people like that, and I just, there are moments that happen in a show like that that I couldn't create during a stand-up show because you'd be too self-conscious about it. You'd be second-guessing yourself. You'd be thinking, oh, this is pretentious twaddle. But in the heat of the moment, you're just, it flows out of you and you can't, there isn't time to stop it. So whatever comes into your mind, you have to say it. And that's why what I meant when I said that, looking back on tonight's show, just thinking about it myself, I thought, you know, parts of it seemed juvenile to me and just a bit kind of, not shallow thinking, but maybe not very well-developed thought processes. So, but I'm glad it had an effect on you. I blushed there. I don't know if you can see that on
on the podcast. And are you going for... It seemed to me like you were so definitely trying not to get any easy laughs. Like, what is the most... At one point, I was trying to have an idea of what kind of rules you've set yourself. And you said some of them there, like no audience suggestions. And is that a conscious kind of, right, these are the principles of the performance?
Well... No, because there are no rules, because it's about what happens. So if somebody from the audience shouts something up, then that becomes part of the show. That's totally fine. There are people who do that kind of thing wonderfully. I think Dara O'Brien does it magnificently, where he riffs off the front row. I think people like Jason Byrne, and I have a very limited kind of education in terms of this thing. I think Ross Noble... there are people like that who I think, a bando man that I saw with my children earlier on today. There are loads of people who do and work brilliantly feeding off suggestions from people. But that's not what I want to do. I think part of it is about realising that there's no such thing really as a career. That is such a daft harness to put on yourself. We're not building anything that will last. So it's about the moment and what's the most enjoyable moment. And I think an experience like this, like what I'm trying to do, is more... I think it's more worthwhile. Even though it's not as funny, even though it's very stressful, even though it's... Like, the relief when I finish, because I do it every second night. And I don't have to do it again until, what day is today? Monday, is it? I don't have to do it again until Wednesday or Thursday. And I'm so happy. But I woke up this morning so stressed. So that philosophy informs it. There's no such thing as a career. And that's a very human but ultimately restricting way to view your life, you know.
Something you said on stage at the beginning of the performance I saw was that you were, as you were kind of explaining it, but it wasn't that you came out and said, right, here's what I'm going to try and do. It became the text of the show in the early part of the show. Something you said was that you were trying not to say anything that you'd ever said before. Mm. And I wondered whether there must be some element of your decision to embark on this kind of show which is based on the fact that you've been a comedian for, I mean, how many years now?
20 nearly.
Nearly 20 years. And you have performed countless shows. You've got several DVDs. You've had lots and lots of live tours. You've worked all over the world. Is there a sense, I wondered whether you're kind of exasperated with your, not so much your current body of work, but I mean, if you're talking in terms of a career, maybe it is that. Do you feel like you want to get beyond... I'm asking several questions at once. I suppose I'm
only
going
to answer one of them.
Yeah, you pick one. But do you see what I mean? Is there some sense whereby you're tired of just writing a show in the way that you usually write a show?
Maybe. I don't know. I couldn't give a definitive answer to that. It seemed, no, when I started doing stand-up, it seemed like the right thing to do. I've done some shows that I wouldn't say I'm ashamed of, but I can notice currents in them. There have been a few angry shows. I'm glad I'm the far side of that. This seems like the right thing to do. The wisdom of it, I don't know. I can justify it very kind of, you know, in terms of art, and that's slightly worrying, because once you can do, if you're able to do that, maybe you're on the wrong, you know, you're Bono, and that's such a cop out to use him as a reference. I'm awful sorry, Bono. I'm not answering your question very well. I don't know, Stuart, to be honest with you. It seems like the right thing to do. I'm not bored of stand-up. I'm not bored of my stand-up. I'm not bored of my shows. I enjoy doing crafted material for people. But crafted material is about working the room. Crafted material is about listening to the audience and judging the laughs and thinking, you know, how are the acoustics on this room? Are they getting all the jokes? You know, do I need to pick up the pace a little bit? They didn't like that bit. Will they like? So I know how to do that. And I know how to craft a show. It's still very difficult to do, but I'm able to do it. I can't predict I'll be able to craft another show, but I have been able to do it. This type of work is different. It's less about listening to the audience and more about finding your mouth and hoping words come out of it. So it's less about listening to the crowd. It's more about listening to yourself and hoping that the time you spend with an audience in an improvised show, that it's better. Because when you're doing a material show, you're the man. You know, you're kind of, yeah, and then this, and then that, and ha, 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 ha. And everyone's going, oh, my God. And I'm going, yeah, oh, my God. And you can work it, and you can be very stylistic, and you can be, you know, you're massaging, you're taking chances, and then you're talking in a whisper. You're working the room. And then you've been very dramatic. And that's all fine. It is convoluted, but it's fine. That's more about the audience, though, than it is about me. This type of work is different. And I'm sorry that I'm not very good at explaining it. And
you're explaining it perfectly. We're totally with you.
Okay, great.
So, yeah, well, and that concludes. So what are you... That's interesting, your description of the craft and your description of what it means to be almost, I don't want to say showboating, but that moment of... And I think a lot of comics have had moments... I fall into a trap of being slick a lot of the time, whereby I like it. I used to be a street performer. I like it when I can pull a trick off.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It feels like attempting a difficult trick and going boom, and you get the beat just right.
Yeah.
And you say it because you learned a lesson last night or 3 nights ago, and you go, this is, bang, they've got it, and you get the laugh.
It is fine. It is showing off. It is false. It is entertaining. It is value for money. But it is depressing for the performer. That type of work is depressing for the person who's doing it. I know this fantastic comic, Owen O'Neill, who got a standing ovation in Montreal for a show he did.
for working the room, being the man. Walked off stage, slammed the dressing room door, said, Canadians, what the fuck do they know? So there is that thing of lifelessness doing... It is professionally responsible to do material. It's, you know, you're being a good boy. And I don't want to put that down too much because I do it. That's how I earn most of my money, is by performing shows, you know. But there's something, you know, I'm drawn to this other thing entirely. And I don't want to undersell the difficulty of it. I mean, it is really, really hard. And I don't want to come across as somebody who is kind of, you know, trying to sell themselves as, you know, the most honest or the most hardworking or the whatever, you know, the most virtuous. I'm aware that it might sound like that, and that's not what I'm about. I'm just trying to honestly say that this other type of work is, you'd agree, it's not as funny as stand-up, but there's something in it, and maybe I haven't got it right just yet, and maybe I never will, but it's at the moment I'm doing it.
If you'll forgive a slight break, these have got quite weird microphones, you need to point them right at your
face. Sure. All that lost?
That's way better. No, we got it. We got it because I started pointing my one at yours. So yeah. Pointing the thing works.
So I've learned it off by heart. I can say it word for word.
So when you give the example...
You're only getting that now, okay.
Oh, no, I got it, and then I kind of felt like I really got it. It was great. When you give the example of Owen O'Neill, could you give yourself as an example? Have you had situations where you've absolutely just been the prince of the room and then walked off and thought, oh, for fuck's sake?
Yeah, because I think there's mood swings in stand-up. I think that if you give yourself totally to a room, wholeheartedly, energetically, in a sharing way, and you're elevated by the laughter, and you're so lifted and expanded by the experience, you know, and naturally you have to come back to yourself, because that's not a livable place that you're in. So it might be, you know, that's why a lot of comics might go for a few drinks after a show, because they want to just keep the kind of the buzz going. But I would often say do a show and it would go fantastically well and get a standing ovation. And it's kind of like, you know, you're the wizard of some kind of wild, maniacal, hysterical energy. And the crowd leave the room kind of saluting you and the mayhem you've created. And 20 minutes later... you could be so sad in your room by yourself because that energy has left you.
And they've taken it away. They've taken it away to have it with their friends.
Sucked you dry. Yeah. You're a prune. So I've had those experiences a lot there. One of the things I do is I either go for a drive after the show. There's three ways of coping. Drinking, get into a car straight after show is great. You're full of ego still, you know. So I have all these. It has to be a sing along CD. It has to be.
Yeah, right.
It has to be so you can be Bob Dylan for an hour and a half.
You know? That's so good. You know,
standing on the water. Kissing your bread and you're driving through the town like talking to people with the eyes of the idol with the iron head. And it takes about an hour for that. So an hour, and you might only be driving because you might be staying in that town that night, but just driving around in circles. You start to come back to yourself. Another way of coping with the energy then is drinking. You come off the show and you start filling yourself with spirit, then it's fantastic, and that's a fine way to do it. The third way is by just accepting the Tao of depression that is approaching and downloading a really fucking awful film. set in Poland about abortion. And just kind of indulging your sadness and being the loneliest, saddest man. So they're the three ways of coping.
Okay.
I don't have any of those issues after the improvised show.
Do you not?
No.
You don't, so you come off feeling what? Sort of shriven?
No, after the improvised show, I'm, for about an hour afterwards, I'm slightly dislocated. I'm just a bit spaced. I feel as if I've been through something. I feel as if I'm just spaced. I'm kind of, it's like if you imagine waking up a baby, just sometimes when you're, if they're your parents or when we were all children and you had to like go somewhere at 3 o'clock in the morning. Yeah. you're kind of woken up. You're not really speaking and you're really cute. And you're in your pyjamas in the baby seat in the car. And this guy, I look around, go, this is brilliant. What is happening? So I'm a little bit like that after the improvised show.
And is there, I mean, the thing about this, I've seen people improvise parts of shows before, and normally they would equate it with writing a show. You're not making notes after these shows and going, oh, that bit worked, or are
no.
you?
No, not sure you can't. Because the mood determines the material, and the material is only relevant to the mood. So you can't recreate the material unless you have the same mood. And the mood in the improvised show is so specific and so stressful and so kind of intense that whatever you do wouldn't recreate it. So no, it's not about, you don't, there's no point in, I have thought of releasing them, you know, as podcasts or albums, you know. So after Edinburgh now, I'll have an 8 CD Tommy Tiernan live in Edinburgh. It'd be 8 CDs long. Who was going to buy that? So there possibly may be something I'd like to do with the shows, but I think being in the moment, like you as a punter who've been to the show, say, okay, it was very definitely in the moment. I don't know if that moment is revisitable.
Yes.
So, I don't know.
Okay.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Maybach, your premier destination for luxury resale. Elevate your style with our curated collection of bags, watches, and fine jewelry. At Rebag, quality is our priority. Each piece meticulously vetted and verified by experts, ensuring your investment is nothing short of perfection. Buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Hermes, Chanel, and Cartier. Access expertly crafted and hard-to-find pieces that redefine luxury. Your next investment awaits at Rebag. Get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. That's 10% off the luxury you deserve. Don't miss out. Head to Rebag.com and enter code REBAG10 at checkout. That's REBAG10.
Tommy Tiernan, ladies and gentlemen. I mean, what a sweet man. I'd never met him before, and he was the very first person I tried to book for this year. As soon as I knew, for the Edinburgh run, as soon as I knew he was going to be at the festival, I started badgering his management something like 4 months ago, and they very rightly said, yeah, why don't we just sort of wait and see. But very, very pleased that we could make it work. So thank you to Tommy, and thank you to everyone in his camp that helped make it happen, and to everyone that came along to this live recording on PBH's Free Fringe at Black Medicine. It was a lovely little cafe on Nicholson Street, and we had some very good times there. I won't say any more about Tommy. I mean, this image of him standing in the darkness in hooves with his Mickey out is an enduring one. That's probably all you need to know for now. Really, really enjoyed this conversation. He absolutely is one of the ilk of... can you use it that way around? He's one of Phil K's ilk, is the expression. And it's fascinating that he actually refers to Phil in this conversation and holds him in such high esteem. I mean, he's just one of those people who seems to be possessed of possessed for one thing, but also seems to regard and experience comedy as an elemental force.
Hugely inspiring. And we'll get back to him in a second. Just time to say thank you very much for all your kind comments about the Edinburgh show so far. The Catherine Ryan and John Lloyd podcasts have proved predictably popular. Not to call you predictable, but I was very hopeful that they would be well received. And they were indeed. I've had loads of lovely comments from people online. You can tweet me at ComComPod. I read all your tweets. I bother to read all of your tweets. It's such a poor claim, I know. And I really try to get back to some of you, to most of them, even if it's weeks later. I'm so terribly bad at Twitter, but there it is. Do get in touch with me at ComComPod. You can follow my own solo stand-up Twitter, which I use even less. So you are guaranteed. It's like a nice little treat every so often. You go, oh, Goldsmith wants to know how to tile a floor. I'm glad I'm following him. That's at Stu Goldsmith. So that's some of our communication channels. Look at my own website, stuartgoldsmith.co.uk, and the new recently updated comedianscomedian.com site, which is, I hope, both deep and sticky. Those are perfectly legitimate web terms, if you know what you're talking about. You can discuss this episode at comedianscomedian.com, and you can also join the Facebook group or leave Facebook comments underneath the episodes at the new website. Merch coming soon. I'm always telling you it's coming soon. Look, and I'm speaking to myself here. I'm addressing you as if this is you saying this, but I'm actually addressing myself. Give me a break, man. I'll sort the merch out. I promise. I've got it all. It's in my fiance's house under the stairs in a large box. I've got both amazing comedianscomedian.com laminates, which say access no areas. They're a fun thing, prove very popular. And also some lovely T-shirts as well. I will sort it out. None of you are putting any pressure on me to do it. The pressure is me putting it on myself, and I just don't think of it in the week until I get round to recording these little belts, these sort of intros and outros of the episodes. And then I just create this fictional argument between myself and the merch hungry public, such as yourself. So we will have those before too long. I am furiously packing now to charge off to Bestival. And then almost as soon as I get back, I will. Oh, sorry, if you're at Bestival, how are you listening to this? And why aren't you snorting Nesquik off an iPhone in a ditch somewhere? If you are, you can come and see me comparing the comedy tent, Bestival, Bestiversity, Comedy Bestiversity, something along those lines. And then as soon as I get back next week, I am absolutely legging it to LA, ladies and gentlemen, to go to the LA Podcast Festival. I've seen the schedule. The lineup's fantastic. I was very excited to see that my friends Tim Batt and Guy Montgomery are there. Both excellent comics. You'll remember them. I spruiked up their podcast before. They're a couple of Kiwi comics who do a podcast called The Worst Idea of All Time, which I've talked about before what the show is. If you would like to know what The Worst Idea of All Time is, please check out their podcast. You can search for that via iTunes and all the usual places. And if that has piqued your curiosity, please find out. It genuinely is the worst idea of all time, and they're absolute lunatics for attempting it. For completing it and attempting even more of this terrible, terrible thing. I never like to tell you who I've booked until they're absolutely locked in, but I'm certainly having a series of very interesting conversations at the moment, trying to get some great American and international acts onto the show, particularly trying to target people who travel to Britain a bit less often than others. So that's all. I promised it'd be short, and once again, I've broken my promise. Let's get back. No, let's not. Let's look, you know this. It's the donations, isn't it? If you'd like to support the show, if you want me to be able to go to LA, I'm so thrilled that I am travelling to LA and putting myself up in this podcast festival entirely thanks to your generous donations. Thank you so much. I won't do a hard sell this time. You know how to do it. Comedianscomedian.com. Press the donate button. Think of a number, however much you think the podcast is worth to you, and fire that donation at me via PayPal, via that link, or you can, of course, come up to me, press some cash into my hand in the street and say something cool. If even one person did that to me during the LA Podcast Festival, give me some dollar bills, y'all, make it rain. I will be so thrilled. But thank you. I'll leave the hard sell for today and just say thank you, because I wouldn't be able to be taking myself to LA without you guys. And there are some potentially very exciting things happening as a result of that. So thank you from the bottom of my little comedy heart. Right, let's get back to Tommy Tiernan, and I'll speak to you at the end. Why would you say that, Stu? You always do speak to them at the end. No one needs to know this. Wittering, fade out, talking to self. God, I'm... Tired.
So I want to talk for a bit about your back catalogue, if you like, your previous material up to this point and what's led you to this point. Because I've never seen you live before. I've seen a lot of your DVDs, I've seen stuff on YouTube. And it strikes me that you as a performer have a really unique kind of mythic quality. The stuff you talk about, the subjects you talk about, you seem to be tapping into an incredibly human experience, and more so than I would expect from another comedian, from Owen O'Neill or from Dara. There's something, I was thinking about this earlier on, I think from your very first live DVD, there's a story, it might be from a different one, but the sort of the sense of you, like if I were to draw like a typical Tommy Tiernan story, would have you standing on a windswept moor by the end of the story, and it would be midnight, and you'd have your Mickey out, and you'd have hooves instead of feet. Do you know what I mean? It's almost like there's a kind of a mythological...
music to my ego, that one.
Yeah. Do you know what I mean? But do you know what I mean? It's like the stuff that you talk about.
The Heathcliff of stand-up comedy.
Yeah. There.
Yeah. I there's no way of answering that, but I will answer tangentially by saying that... I saw Rich Hall recently, and it pleased me so much that there is space in what we do for the older, wilder man. That it's not, even though there are any amount of young, good-looking, bland, talented teeth people out there. And they're fine. And,
sorry, just for the benefit of the listener, I just attempted to hide my teeth using my gums.
And that's fine. And that, but the fact that people like that older people, and maybe the older, you know, Rich is an amazing comic. There are older, brilliant comedians in America, you know, that. So in terms of that, maybe the stand-up thing is more like poetry writing or being a novelist or an actor, maybe, rather than the boy band stand-up thing, which is has its place. So I'm just pleased that the older I get, the balder I get, the longer my wife can tolerate my beard. That there's a place for that. There's a place. I'm 46, you know, and I still feel strong for stand-up. I still feel as if there's bull energy in me. You know, there isn't kind of mad calf energy. I've had that and it's awful crack. But I feel as if the energy in me now is slightly more bullish and older, and I'm delighted that my business tolerates that, that older people have a place in stand-up comedy. I don't know, we don't really see them, do we, on TV and stuff? Like, off the top of my head, I can't really think of an older stand-up who's on telly. And by older, I mean maybe 50 and grey and balding. I can't, you know, I can't think of somebody, so but they're out there.
Do you think that the what you would call a boy band comedian, there are people I know who fit that bill, and a lot of them don't want to be that. They want to be wild. What is it, do you think, that is stopping them?
Well, now, genuinely?
Yeah.
Despair.
Go on.
That you can't fake it, you know? It has to be real. Your sadness is real. So that's all it is. It's acknowledging sadness. Thinking. I don't know. You can't say how to be wild, because if you said, if there was an answer to how to be wild, then that's not wild. You know, that's a pose. So real wildness, I suppose, has its own something or other. I don't know. I don't know.
I think it is. I see what you mean about it being a pose. But in the, like, you must have made choices as a younger comedian to talk about specific things So there must have been, or maybe they weren't choices. There must have been specific things that were important to you.
Yeah.
That you wanted to talk about.
Absolutely, yeah.
That you let yourself be led by.
Yes, absolutely.
So what sorts of things were those in the earlier parts of your career?
Girls and religion. I suppose they're the two big things that have kind of stayed with me. The show I'm doing at the moment is, you know, there's bits about girls and bits about God. And so I think they're probably the two things, you know, that have, you know, I have six children, so I end up talking about them as well, which is kind of, you know, a bit obvious, I suppose. They're the things that I end up talking about all the time because I guess they're important to me in some way.
And do you ever, or have you ever, kind of had material that was funny, that worked, but that wasn't important enough, so you ditched it?
Oh,
or
completely.
It wasn't important to you?
Yeah, I can't think of it right now, but yeah, of course, yeah. Because you're not involved in it. You have to be involved in the material. You have to either delight at the silliness of it, you have to either enjoy the stupid joke of it, or you have to be somehow passionate about the subject you're talking about. So, but there are no absolutes. I mean, even as I'm saying these things, I can adopt an alternative position. So, there are no absolutes. You know, So yeah.
When you do you know what I mean by the madness? Like you referred to earlier on, the calf kind of madness. You are someone who doesn't just go and, you know, tear the roof off rooms.
Well, I'll tell you a story now, and this wouldn't have happened if I was doing an improvised show, because an improvised show isn't fake. So yeah, okay, in my material shows, there is an element of wildness and mayhem. But it's kind of professional mayhem.
Yeah.
I'm doing a show one time in this mountainy area of Ireland. And a guy turned up in a onesie and antlers. Right? To the show. And he was asked to take the antlers off because the people behind him couldn't see, right? And the bouncers checked again in a few minutes and he had the antlers back on. And he took them off again. And then when the show started, they saw he was on again, they were on again. So the bouncers asked him to leave. And it was one of the most damning things that's ever been levelled at me during the show. He stood up and he shouted, "I was promised madness!" And he left. And he was right. He was right. If he'd have come to an improvised show, that'd have been totally fine. He wouldn't have been. But he came to a kind of a, well, it is madness, but it's still a show. So yeah. I guess that's always stayed with me as an accusation.
Because you must have to contrive the madness sometimes. Is that what you mean?
You have to repeat it.
Yeah.
And that's not, is that madness then? I don't know. So.
When you do TV spots, I saw your Letterman spot from maybe 2007. And it was a great gig. And I was just wondering how you felt about having to contain the madness, to contain what you do in that professional way.
I'm always
for a tight seven on TV.
Yeah, I'm always awful on television. I get really, really, really nervous. And I did a radio thing this morning that was being filmed, and I got really nervous. So I get very, very nervous on those.
What
things.
Is it that you're scared of? That surprises me. Is that because you feel like you can't be your real self?
Yeah,
you've got to submit a transcript or something.
I think
for
something? So. It's something that I suppose I could get better at, but I just get phenomenally nervous, you know. And I don't enjoy them, to be honest.
I spoke to John Lloyd last night on this podcast, and he was talking about the fact he never felt nerves. He didn't care. He believed in what he was saying and what he planned to say so much that it just never struck him. And I think Sam Simmons as well, another kind of mad and sometimes, you know, professionally mad by necessity comedian. His feeling is that he's so convinced that what he's doing is funny that it doesn't matter what they think.
Jesus, I'd love that.
Yeah, right? So what part of you is nervous? What part of you is scared? What do you worry could go wrong?
They don't like me, that I'm not funny, that I'm a fool, that I'm an idiot, that I'm pretending, that I'm fake, and I'm useless.
But why would those things matter to you if you have that calf madness or that bull madness inside you? Is it just something that you can only sometimes contact?
No,
and the rest of the time you're sort of mild-mannered?
No, I don't get nervous in front of... I wasn't nervous before we did this. You know, I was looking forward to it. Still am. because I kind of felt, okay, here's an opportunity. I'm a great man for talking about myself. That doesn't seem to be a problem for me. But I enjoy waffling and talking about myself. I do enjoy that, in fairness.
That is fair.
But a television thing, I don't know what it is. I just don't feel, as if I'm strong and honest and determined enough to be myself or something. I can't put my finger on it, really. So I don't know, but I don't enjoy it.
Over the years, how many DVDs have you released?
About 8, I think.
And are you happy with all of them, some of them, any of them?
No. I think the first one was very good. Second one was good. The third one was good. The fourth one wasn't great.
Why was that? Fifth one was awful.
Genuinely awful.
Why was that? And by whose standards? Was it received well, but you weren't happy with it? Or?
No, I think people kind of started to suspect, this guy is not always going to be funny. And I think the last two have been good, very good. But there was definitely two in the middle that were tough. I wouldn't recommend them. You know, I absolutely would. I hate seeing them in shops. I've tried to get them not to be given to shops anymore. I really don't like them. There's two of them I really don't like. The rest of them, I think, are, you know, I don't watch them. I haven't seen them in years, and sure. I wouldn't. I was on television in Ireland about 2 weeks ago, and I didn't know. I was flicking around, and I saw myself, and I watched 10 minutes, and it was so fucking depressing. there's two that are fairly brutal, I think, anyway.
Why was it depressing?
I could see all the jokes coming. It just didn't seem funny to me.
Because you obviously you know what the punchline's going to be because you wrote and performed the joke hundreds and hundreds of times.
It seemed fake. Yeah, it seemed fake.
What, if there were a spotter, if there were someone who was like an obsessive Tommy Tiernan fan, do you think they'd be able to tell the fakeness, or is it just something you can see?
I've no idea. I've never met an obsessive Tommy Tiernan fan.
There's definitely one at the back, at least.
All right. I don't know, really. I don't know.
Just to stay with that, and I know it's a negative thing to talk about, okay. I hope you don't mind, but just to stay with those ones that you didn't like, were they tour shows that you did like but the records weren't great?
No, they were... No,
they were actually shows that you
didn't
like?
Yeah, the material was... I was more angry than creative. It was kind of like... The phrase I used for it, I was like Frankie Boyle on Cheap Speed. It was just angry.
The mic may not have picked up someone in the background going, oh, God.
It was very angry. It was gnarly. It wasn't playful. There was no joy in it. And it took me 2 or 3 years to work that out of my system, really. And the way I worked it out of my system was, I decided to do I said, how am I going to get to the far side of this phase? And I thought to myself, well, I'll talk and talk until I'm not angry anymore. So I got up on stage and I did a show that lasted 36 hours and 15 minutes. And
By design, you didn't.
By
just
design,
you know,
that
overrun.
Wasn't just like a some kind of janitor looking at his clock going, we're in the Thursday night show now. And I did that around April. And by the following October, the anger had gone. So it worked as a method, I think. So that's what I did.
How did you physically, how were you able to keep going for 36 hours?
I just did. I just kept going.
With that, and you weren't repeating stuff? Did you do
material?
No, I
was. We contacted, I wanted to do it. So I said, I'm going to do this thing. I'm going to do a phenomenally long gig. Because I was interested in where that I might end up creatively with that. And then, so once that was in place, then other things started attaching themselves. It became something else. We contacted the Guinness Book of Records to say, is there the world's longest stand-up comedy gig? And they said, no, not yet. And then we contacted a charity in Galway saying, we'll do this for you. If we get, we'll charge people in and we'll give the money to you. And so it became this thing then. So once it became an event, there was no kind of backing out of it. Mm. And I did. I started at 3 o'clock on Good Friday, and I performed until I was trying to get to dawn on Easter Sunday, but I was too shook. So I lasted until 3:15, or something like that, 6:15 or something on Easter Sunday morning. But as a process in terms of the stand up, it worked. I was able the following October. I just noticed it. I said, stuff I'm doing now on stage is much more playful than that kind of... I was interested in, and it's good to have comics who do this. I was interested in destruction. It's important to have antisocial comics. It's important to have people who are reckless on stage. It's important to have, in the moment of comedy, sexist comedy is important. Racist comedy is important. These things that make us feel uncomfortable, and there's a place for them. I'm a big believer in freedom of speech on stage. That something happens in a room where the audience and the performer agree, we're not going to take things seriously. And I think there's a place for that type of angry, destructive, it might even be unpleasant to watch, but you can't ban it. And I don't know these things for sure. Like I'm throwing them out there. That it's important, I think, that those comics exist, or that those routines exist. And I feel as if that's fine. And I feel as if I've kind of been through that. I don't want to go back there. It's not what I'm about now. It doesn't make me happy or joyful to think that I did it or anything like that. But I think it's important to have. But it's not. I've no interest in it now. So,
You think? I mean, you saying that's it's important to have racist comedy sexist comedy. That's
it's
not the same as
not to take. We get so wound up about things. You know, we get so kind of righteous and constricted and precious, and it's born out of a good energy because we don't want to offend anybody, we want to be nice people, and we want to kind of love. But it's important to have those things challenged. It's important to go into a room and you know, if someone tells a racist joke or something and a person shouts out from the back, that's racist. That's fine. That's all part of the process. I'm not saying that the person back there should shut up. But I'm saying that the person on stage, there should be a place for that. A place where normal, loving standards don't apply. Not as a... You know, not as the only thing stand-up is used for, as a moment. You know, I think that's important. You know, I do. I was shocked. Do you remember that guy, Michael Richards?
Yeah.
Who was banned. He lost his mind one night.
Kramer from Seinfeld.
Yeah, he lost his mind on stage one night and started, you know, calling people names and stuff like that. And the reaction to that was shocking. The reaction to that, to me, was shameful. You know, we either have these rooms where freedom of speech is possible. You know, I hope you could sense I'm not, you know, I'm not either racist or sexist or anything like that.
Have you been the victim of racism or sexism? Or are you...
The victim of racism or sexism?
Yeah. Or are you not actually in a very privileged position? Do you see what I mean? Like, what I'm suggesting is maybe it's okay for you to think like that because you were in a privileged position whereby you haven't been harmed by a racist or a sexist joke.
Sure. And like, and I don't really have an answer to that. So this isn't a debate where, and I completely take on board what you're saying. Completely. There's wisdom in what both of us are saying, but I completely take on board what you're saying.
And do you think that it's the nature of a comedy gig, that room, you've said that a couple of times, that the room, the special place, the kind of the sacredness of it, that makes things different? So there's a place for a racist or a sexist joke within the confines, within the established context of this is a comedy gig and we're not being serious. Do you think that is separate to and apart from a conversation between friends in a staff room?
No, John, I think maybe to further develop what we're saying... I think that if there's hate in somebody, an audience can identify it and can be repelled by it. And I'm not talking about legitimizing hate. I'm not talking about that. I'm not saying hate is a good thing or hate is legitimate or there's a place for hate.
Okay.
So I'm not, yeah. This is really, you can tell by the tension in the room that we're in a place that we're all kind of slightly, okay, where is this going? Who's in charge? And we're not entirely sure where we're going, which is fantastic. It's not about legitimizing hate at all.
I think this comes back to the description I was attempting earlier on of your work as somehow, if not mythic, then kind of archetypal. Do you know what I mean? There is, when you talk about having the calf wildness or the bull wildness, it seems to me that you're sort of talking about a kind of a joker spirit or like a coyote spirit or a kind of Brer Rabbit type spirit.
Yeah, sure. That's a dangerous, and I mean this, that's a dangerous spirit. You know, that is, and I've experienced it, culture does not appreciate that.
Yes.
There's a story told about that that destructive trickster energy is actually the link between humans and heaven in a way that the trickster destroys all concepts, offends everybody, takes nothing seriously, but there's something in his spirit that is divine. But I can tell you that it is not a enjoyable place to be. I can tell you that it is, you attract hate. And I've been through it twice, I think.
Mm.
It's not good. It's not a nice place to be.
Do you feel battered by it? I feel like you're choosing your words carefully whilst wanting to say something important. You're also, I mean, presumably you must be mindful that in interviews like this, in situations like this, things that you've said have created that hate, have created that controversy. And it must be exasperating to not want to explain yourself again when bombarded with on forums and message boards. but also you passionately want to say what you feel.
Well, no, I'm just talking about that trickster energy. And it's a... There are consequences. You know, it's not a pose. It's not some kind of fashionable position. It's actually, personally, a really, really difficult place to be. Because you start to question yourself. Other people start... It's a fucking hard place to be, and it's you know, but it's real. I don't know. It's a hard place to be, is what I say to you. Yeah.
Sure. I wonder whether part of it is in the spirit of kind of like carnival, of like the one day of the year when everyone's roles are reversed. You know what I mean? That sort of spirit of like the jester who's the only person who can talk to the king, the only person who can insult the king. That kind of energy. That only, I suppose, only works if that is a shared cultural understanding that one person has been given the onus to behave like that.
Yeah, you do need culture permission.
Is that maybe the problem that you've had, is that you've given yourself a kind of permission to inhabit that and discover that culture hasn't given that permission?
Yeah, maybe, and the fact that there are... It's amazing how many energies are out there, especially tabloid energy, that is... It's piss energy. It's just, it's horrible. You know, it's vindictive. It's narky. It's telltale-y. It's vicious. It's destructive. I remember I would have read a lot of stuff about Zen and all this type of stuff. And you know, to have no icons and to take no thing seriously. And seemingly there were these monks who used to go around and they'd visit monasteries and they'd take the, you know, say there was a holy bowl, you know, they'd shit in it. Right? And, you know, the other monks would go, that's Buddha's, like, that's disgusting. And they go, it's just a bowl, what are you talking about? So, but when you do that...
You might be killed.
You might be killed, yeah. If you pissed in a chalice, in a church, can you imagine what happened to you? So I don't know. It's a very difficult thing to talk about in the sense that because it I don't feel as if we're talking about... Like, it's absoluteless. There isn't a definite theory, or you kind of... We're trying to describe... It's like trying to describe a cloud. It's kind of... Well, it's just, you know, it's very hard, so...
Thank you for that answer. Thanks for taking your time over it. I appreciate it. Which... We're slightly low on time. We've got about 10 minutes left. And I wanted to ask, which of your prepared material have you been most proud of? Which part of your prepared material has come the closest to what you're trying to attain with your unprepared performance?
None of it really. genuinely, because you know, there are jokes in the show that I'm doing at the moment that I enjoy in the material show. I enjoy them. I enjoy the silliness of them. I enjoy the crowd reaction to them. I enjoy... the joy it gives people to be laughing at them. But I would never say I was proud of them. They're just silly. I got one actually. I was watching 8 out of 10 cats one night, and I was pretending I was on it.
My research fails me. Have you been on it before?
I've never been on it. Okay. I'd be shitting myself. I'd be no good. But I was at home watching myself. I was at home watching it in front of the television, pretending I was on it. Right? So a question would be asked, and I'd try and come up with an answer. So they had this question about obesity. You know, one of the top 10 things is obesity. What would we do about obesity? And I was there at home, and I thought of an answer about obesity. And I didn't know, woke up my wife. And I said, I've just been pretending I was on 8 out of 10 cats.
And they asked a question about obesity, and I said we should hunt obese people. That'd be a cure for it, you know. So a bit of material developed around the notion of hunting obese people that is in my stand-up show is quite funny. It's so I enjoy the silliness of that. And
yes.
But I wouldn't say I was proud of it. Like, I wouldn't, you know, I don't think I'm proud of such an odd concept. I wouldn't be proud of anything, really.
Why is that an odd concept? Do you not have a bit that you go, oh, that's it, that bit I nailed?
No.
Or is that exactly what you're trying to destroy?
No, you can, any given night you might say, God, that section was fantastic. Or when you're in the middle of a section and you just know every bit of it is being picked up on, you have the feeling, this is happening. And that's very, but you couldn't afterwards ever say that you're proud of it. You enjoy it. I don't think one is proud of these things. So.
Okay. We've just got a few minutes left. If you're happy to take some questions from the audience.
I'm sure if they're still awake.
That's a really good question. Do you think that there can be a female trickster energy?
Let's not rush an answer here. Let's take the time to consider this one properly. Mythically, would there be one? I'm trying to think of Grace. I wouldn't have a huge knowledge now of female gods, but they would seem to embrace creativity and destruction. There would seem to be able to, that there are their strengths, death and birth. I'm not sure. I'm the few gods. Isn't there Shiva? Is Shiva male or female?
Shiva's
Shakti.
And is Shakti destructive and?
She's the one that she's Shiva's female energy, and she's the trickster. She makes the world, which is illusion, and Shiva is the passive, which is the male. He just experiences it.
But you don't see it in comedy. It's kind of worse.
Yeah. I think it's certainly there in comedy. I think there are anarchic female comedians at this festival. I'd go and see Holly Byrne.
Yeah, so do I.
I think maybe they're less prevalent. I mean, I think that's... But then, I'm not sure.
I'm not sure either. I don't know. You asked a specific question about trickster, and trickster is mythic. Trickster isn't the same as comedy. So there are amazing female stand-ups, amazing. One of my favourites that I've come across recently is Catherine Ryan.
Yeah.
Brilliant. Slightly wild, so clever, brilliant energy on stage, but I couldn't equate her with, say, with Phil Kay, who seems to be, you know, the consummate trickster, energy, destructive and positive, and so I'm not, that's it, yeah.
We'll look harder, and anyone listening or who would like to email in or come and talk to us afterwards, I'm thinking off the top of my head of people like Petra Massey and Holly Byrne and I can't remember the lady's name, but she's playing a character called Dave here, and there's a show called Dave. I think it might be Laura Coombs Maher, and also Misbehave. I think there's quite a lot of trickster energy amongst female.
Eleanor Tiernan, who's my cousin as well, is also...
Yeah, absolutely. All friends of the show. Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, we must finish there because we're about to get kicked out. Thank you, Tommy.
Thanks for tolerating me. It's been an interesting journey.
I normally like to bring it back to... I like to ask my guests finally, so you'll need to answer this very quickly. What would you have on your comedy gravestone?
Ah, well, now, I tell you what. I learnt this quote the other night... from a wonderful lady, and it was John Keats's, what's written on his gravestone, is, "Here lies a man whose name was writ on water." and his name isn't on it. That's all it says. Here lies a man whose name was writ on water. So
that'll do.
Thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Tommy.
That's great.
So that was Tommy Tiernan. What a brilliant guy. I was going to say, what a brilliant interview. Pat on the back for Stu. That's not what I mean at all. What an intense and fascinating experience to talk to someone who through whom comedy speaks in such a fashion. So thank you so much to Tommy for coming along. And thanks to everyone at Black Medicine as well. And also Megan Pugh, who was helping me out throughout the whole of this run. And also, of course, Nathan Wood, who co-produces this show, like all of them these days, the plucky little worker bee that he is. Thanks, Nathan. So that's all for now. Coming up next week, probably Matt Lucas. Shall we get that one out? Shall we wham that out? Or will I? Yeah, I won't have recorded anything in LA by then. Slam, clack, clang is what I meant to say. I won't have recorded anything in LA by then, guys. So let's see if we can get that Matt Lucas episode ship shape and wham you that next week. And then great, loads more great stuff. Ronnie Cheng and Jason Byrne and Aisling B and Mae Martin and Will Durst shortly after that as well. Fascinating guy. So stay tuned. You don't tune, do you? Stay locked in. I can't even bring myself to pastiche a pirate radio station. Keep it locked in. No. Just keep listening to the show. Thank you. Donate at comedianscomedian.com, or you can do your bit by sharing the show with a friend. Let's get the word out. Let's have a little push to tell some more people about the show. When you've got an episode as good as this one, let's get it out there. Thanks for listening, and I will speak to you very soon. Bye for now.
We're all looking to make more sustainable choices, but making your own shoes out of natural materials could pose a few challenges. The twigs and leaves in your yard aren't exactly comfortable, and while mud does perfectly contour the feet, it doesn't score high on the durability front. But thanks to Allbirds, you can skip all the backyard experimentation. At the Allbirds Innovation Lab, they're doing all the sciencey stuff like research and testing to create shoes from natural, sustainable materials. And their innovative processes mean using less of the bad stuff and more of the good, while making shoes unlike any other. Like the Plant Pacer, made with 100% plastic-free plant leather. The Tree Dasher, a running shoe made from eucalyptus tree fiber. And from Sugarcane, they've made the Superlite, their lightest shoe ever by weight and carbon footprint. It's not rocket science, it's shoe science. Allbirds is making shoes better than natural. They're super natural. Find your perfect pair at allbirds.com today. That's ALLBIRDS.com.